This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. 22 cities and towns in Vermont use Lake Champlain as their municipal drinking water source. In previous summers, state officials only tested the water if blue-green algae was reported near a drinking water intake. This summer, water will be routinely tested once a week for the algae's toxins. State toxicologist Sarah Vos explains why.
EPA does not require any sort of water monitoring for these toxins. It is a completely voluntary program. And after last summer, when we saw the water supply in Toledo, Ohio, become impacted by a blue-green algae toxin, there's been a lot more focus on trying to understand if that is possible here and trying to understand what kind of toxins are present in our raw and finished water.
We hear a lot about why blue-green algae is bad, but you might not know much about the substance beyond that. So today we're going to learn the science behind this cyanobacteria. Joining me in the studio are Angela Shamba, aquatic biologist for the Department of Environmental Conservation, and Mike Winslow, staff scientist with the Lake Champlain Committee. LCC calls itself a citizens advocacy group formed to protect and restore water quality, safeguard natural habitats, and ensure recreational access. Angela and Mike, welcome to Vermont Edition. Nice to have you.
Thanks. You for having us.
So let's talk a little bit about what exactly blue-green algae is. A plant, a bacterium, some hybrid? Mike?
Blue-green algae is actually a bacteria. There are folks that don't like calling it an algae, but that really depends on what your definition of algae is, and that definition has changed over time.
What's your definition of algae?
Algae is definitely a photosynthetic organism mainly living in the water without roots, stems, or leaves. Some people add on another piece of that it has to have a certain sort of cell structure. And blue-green algae don't meet that last criteria. They're a much more primitive organism. They don't have, if you remember back to your high school biology class, they don't have a nucleus. They don't have organelles within the cell. So it's a very much more primitive structure.
Angela, anything to add to that?
No, I'd agree with that completely.
So, you know, sometimes you think of primordial ooze. It sort of looks like blue-green algae might look like primordial ooze. Can you describe for people who haven't seen it what it actually looks like? It's sort of a slick or a series of slicks on the water, right, Angela?
A lot of people will mix it up with paint or some sort of a chemical spill. I saw an interesting description not too long ago from Quebec describing it as a chopped broccoli soup. So it can be kind of crunchy looking. It's greenish, can be blue, can be white, depends on how long it's been exposed to the sun and weather conditions.
And Mike, when you talked about earlier what these organisms actually are, so it looks like this slick on top of the water, but they're actually individual organisms that we're talking about that make up that sort of blob on the water?
That's correct. The individuals are each microscopic, which is one of the ways that when we teach our monitors how to determine whether they're seeing a blue-green algae bloom is if you can pick it up with a stick, it's not blue-green algae. It's some other sort of algae, some sort of other plant. It's most similar to pollen. And pretty much a lot of people have seen pollen on the water. It has that same sort of oily texture. You can't pick up individual particles. It differs from pollen in its color. It doesn't manifest as yellow.
And it can smell bad, Angela.
Certainly.
What does it smell like?
It's described as earthy, fishy. It can be very pungent. I've been out in several blooms, and you know definitely that you are moving through a blue-green algae area. It's difficult to describe because it is a little bit different for every person, what they take away from that smell.
Mike, what do you take away from it?
Nothing I want to keep.
We're talking today about blue-green algae. We're learning a little bit about what it actually is, the cyanobacteria, how it forms. We're going to talk about how it is fed by human activity, why we see these algae blooms in the summertime here in Vermont, often in Lake Champlain. And if listeners, you have questions about maybe blue-green algae near you, maybe you're worried about swimming or taking your dogs to the park and taking your dog swimming, or maybe you just want to know a little bit more about how this bacterium actually grows. Well, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We did get a note from Ray in Hinesburg who says, "We have algae in our pond. How does one tell blue-green algae from regular algae?"
Well, the first cue is, like I mentioned, if you can pick it up with a stick, it's not blue-green algae. It's something else. If it's attached to anything, if it's growing on rocks or growing on a dock, that's not the blue-green algae that we're concerned about. It's the stuff we're interested in is floating in the water column. It's planktonic. Those are the big cues. And then the last one is color. If it's yellow, it's likely to be pollen. If it's something other than yellow, if it's green, if it's blue, it can be a lot of different things, just not yellow. Then you might have blue-green algae.
And Angela Shamba?
A lot of the common pond algae are very stringy, as Mike mentioned before. And as a result of that, when you see them on the water, they're very bumpy, lumpy. They'll capture air bubbles in there. And that's definitely also a regular green algae. People will confuse it with a plant called duckweed. So if you can see two small leaves, roots, it's definitely not an algae either.
We often hear about blue-green algae blooms on Lake Champlain, but can you find it in pretty much any sort of stagnant or still water supply in the state?
Lake Champlain is just one of the places it's found. These are very common organisms. They're native. They're natural pretty much through the entire world. They can colonize extreme environments like hot springs, desert crusts. They're very important in desert crusts. They can be found in the Antarctic. So pretty much any place that is the least little bit wet, standing water, flowing water, it's possible that they're there.
So flowing water, my understanding was that it prefers flat water. Is that true? But it can hang out in flowing water as well?
It can move in flowing water. A lot of times it may come out of a lake or a pond, but it can be found in rivers as well. It just doesn't get a chance to form those scums at the surface because the water's carrying it and moving it.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about what it is and what it looks like, but it can also be harmful. Blue-green algae can form toxins, but not always. So what's going on there, Mike?
We don't know. There's a lot of questions about why they form the toxins, when they form the toxins. Some species form them and others don't. And even within a species, some have the gene to produce the toxin and others don't. They're not necessarily they aren't producing it as a toxin to defend against us or to chase us away. We don't really know why they're using it. It might be predator avoidance. It might be protection from the sun. It might be a signaling to other algae. There's different ideas and different tests about that, but nobody's really sure why they're making the toxins.
Predator avoidance. Who's a predator of blue-green algae?
Lots of stuff out there. There are zooplankton, tiny little animals in the water that will eat it. There are zebra mussels will take it in and preferentially spit out blue-green algae that produce toxins and then digest blue-green algae that don't produce toxins.
Is it also a predator?
No.
But it can outcompete other bacteria, is that right?
And other plants. It gets its food from the sunlight, like a plant. And if there's enough of it, it creates shade, and that reduces some of the other plants out there. Even within blue-green algae, there's different species, there's different types, and they're competing with one another as well.
I was reading something, and I wish I remembered exactly the scientific names, but the different kinds of blue-green algae are sometimes called, what, Annie, Franny, and Mike? Is
Annie,
that right?
Alfie, and Mike.
Annie, Alfie, and Mike. So what those are the different kinds of blue-green algae?
Those are three kinds. There's a lot more than that. Those are the ones that are most likely to be producing toxins: Anabaena, Aphanizomenon, and Microcystis.
And are those the ones that we find more frequently here in Vermont, or are there other kinds as well?
Those are probably the most common ones that we see here, but there are plenty of there are several other kinds as well.
So, Angela, when we talk about the toxins and that they're not always forming toxins, but sometimes they are, what are the toxins that they're forming, and why are they harmful to people and animals?
There are several groups of toxins. The most common one seems to be microcystin. In fact, there are like 80 different variants of microcystin that can be produced. It's found with the testing that's being done across the country and the world. It's one of the more common ones that's found. The other one that's occurred on Lake Champlain in the past occasionally is called anatoxin. It's a neurotoxin, can affect the nerves, whereas microcystin tends to affect the liver. And then there's a third now that we've begun testing for here on Lake Champlain, and it's called cylindrospermopsin, which is also a nerve toxin, I believe. That's one that we have tested for in the past, not recently, and had not found. So this year's testing, including that, will be a new area for us.
And the problem is if somebody ingests these toxins in a high enough quantity, not if you get them on your skin?
There's two different things that go on there. The toxin in general is contained in the cell, and so you do need to ingest it in order to get the toxin. But they also produce other compounds, one of which is a lipopolysaccharide, that that you, if you get that on your skin, you can end up with itches and rashes and that kind of thing. So there's two, there's a couple of different compounds that they have. Some are toxic, some are not.
And Mike, neurotoxins, I mean, that's, I imagine to people sounds like it could be pretty scary.
It certainly does, but that's also something we don't see a lot of. We had an incident back in the late 90s where there were 3 dog deaths in a fairly short period of time resulting from ingesting the anatoxins. We haven't seen that in recent years. I think the most recent possible case was from 2003.
And no cases of people dying.
That's correct. The only cases of people dying that have been confirmed from blue-green algae toxins was in 1996 in Brazil. Those were patients who were on dialysis, and the water that was part of their treatment was contaminated. So it was a compromised immune system to begin with and a vulnerable population.
So how dangerous is blue-green algae in the waterways in Vermont? How worried should people be if they're seeing it?
The worst impact you're likely to see is a stomach ache. There have been illnesses reported from other areas, Kansas, Minnesota. There was a study that came out of Quebec recently that said exposure to these blue-green algae is more likely to lead to stomach distress. The symptoms tend to be not so serious that people go to the hospital, which means that we don't have really good understanding of how extensive they are because it's not being reported.
Mm-hmm. The impact when we do talk about toxicity often has to do with pets. Dogs in particular, when they go to a beach or a waterfront, they don't hesitate to eat the stuff that's on the shore. They drink large amounts of water. I mean, when my dog is swimming chasing a stick, his mouth when he comes back is underwater. He's, you know, drinking a lot of water as well. And so because they've taken in water with the algae and they take in large amounts, they can get enough to cause toxicity. And so there have been, as Mike mentioned, dog illnesses not only here in Vermont but other places across the country. So it is something to pay attention to when you have pets. And small children then, because they're smaller and also not as careful about what they take and where they put their hands after they've been playing on the beach, again, they're the kind, that's where you need to pay attention.
Okay. And so what's the best practice then for when you should or shouldn't be in the water, regardless of whether a beach has been closed by the state?
Right. So an individual algal cell, again, may or may not be producing a toxin. We measure for 3, but there are lots of other ones that might be produced. But that individual cell, if you swallow it, isn't going to cause a problem. It's when you get a lot of them at one time. So what you're looking for is water that has this visible scum on the top that, in my mind, most people should look at it and say, that doesn't look so good. But if you stand on the edge of the beach and you see that discoloration, you can't see the rocks and the twigs perhaps on the bottom, and you know it's not mud, and you know it's not suspended sediment, then to me that's, you know, that's your indication that you definitely want to stay out of it.
And the simple message is, if it's green and scummy, stay out.
Yep.
Okay, got it. If it's green and scummy, stay out. All right, you heard that right.
I'd be surprised how often, though, we've seen people swimming in green, scummy water. Right. So it is a message that has to get out.
Although, from what you're saying, it's probably okay because there are not always toxins produced. In fact, often the toxins aren't produced. So you may be okay, but...
You might be, but you cannot look at a bloom and determine whether or not it's toxic.
Yeah, it's just prudent to just... And on Lake Champlain, and there are plenty of other places to go swimming. So, you know, pack up your car and move a little further down the beach.
Instance we had earlier this week where beaches were closed in the Burlington area, the blooms occurred at North Beach in Letty Park. Oak Ledge was fine. So it can be that short of a distance between where a bloom is and where it isn't.
Where are the typical worst spots on the lake?
Typically, the worst spots are St. Albans Bay and Missisquoi Bay. They have perennially high nutrient concentrations, so there's a lot of food there. With St. Albans Bay in particular, you get a predominant south wind that blows anything that develops in the bay towards the north end of it, and so it accumulates there. We see blooms there pretty much every year. Other places, it's sporadic, hit and miss. More often, it's clean than it's not.
We're going to get into why and how we are feeding these algae blooms in a couple of minutes, but I want to read a note from Anne in Willsboro, New York, who says, "The Lake Champlain Committee Blue-Green Algae Monitoring Program is an excellent way for citizens to directly help monitor the lake for the presence or absence of this dangerous condition. Anyone who swims, boats, or has dogs in the lake has an exposure and a risk to blue-green algae. LCC has made the weekly monitoring process quick and easy and reports back each week about conditions around the lake." So how can can people get involved, and how can they find out about the testing that's being done as well by the state? But Mike, you first.
So the Lake Champlain Committee, in conjunction with the Department of Environmental Conservation and Department of Health, runs a monitoring program for Lake Champlain. We train people to observe algae and determine what is and isn't algae, and then we ask them to go out at least once a week to report back on conditions. And we've trained over 100 people. We're getting reports from about 80 to 90 different sites around the lake each week. All that data, all those data are collected and put onto a website maintained by the Vermont Department of Health. They call it their algae tracker. So anybody that just Googles Vermont Health algae tracker can get to that map. It's updated as we get the reports. Our goal is we get a report within 24 hours. It's going to be live on that website. And it tells you where the blooms are occurring and where they're not. When I was there this morning, you see green dots all over the lake indicating conditions are clean, except in St. Albans Bay, where there's some red ones, including we had a report from yesterday still there, and another what we call a low alert up in Missisquoi Bay. Low alert is a condition where we're starting to see some cells floating in the water, but they haven't formed those thick scums yet.
And we actually have a link to the tracker up at our webpage at vpr.net if you click on Vermont Edition, if people want to see what that looks like. So that's monitoring where the algae is, but not whether or not it has toxins.
That's
right?
Correct. The simple message that we're trying to get out is if the water's green and scummy, stay out of it. We had a program from 2003 to about 2011 where we were collecting water samples and analyzing them, but you don't get those toxin results back for about a week. By the time that's back, the conditions have changed. With North Beach and Leti, they were closed one day and open the next. It can change within an hour even. So instead of investing that money in lab costs, and then because of those lab limitations, we could only have so many sites, we've gone to this visual monitoring approach, which allows anybody to become a monitor just by going through the training, and expanded our network dramatically in the last few years.
But I'd like to add to that, too, that the monitoring system also includes a quantitative, solid, analytical level to it. There is a long-term monitoring program on Lake Champlain that operates in support of the Champlain TMDL. And as part of those visits to those routine sites, we're also collecting algae samples. And as needed, when we see scums, we collect toxin samples as well.
And the TMDL is the total maximum daily load. This is about phosphorus.
About phosphorus and nutrient control. The Department of Health has 10 sites on Lake Champlain and several inland sites where they are not only making the visual assessment that Mike has talked about, they're collecting an algae sample and samples routinely for toxins, whether they see a bloom or not. And some of the Lake Champlain Committee monitors are doing the same thing for us. So we're constantly checking our visual assessment to continue to be confident that when we say the water's green and scummy and that's your worst case scenario, that's when, if toxins are present, that's when it's going to be likely to be the highest concentrations. Every year we're affirming that perception.
And we're also affirming that when our monitors go out and say the water's clear, there aren't toxins in it.
Correct.
And for people who want to find out what the results are of the state testing for toxins, where can they find that?
That data, there's several annual reports that are available online through a DEC website. We don't typically post the toxin concentration results online, but that red dot on there, if you see a red dot, it means either that the conditions are really green and scummy, or the conditions are that the two toxins we have guidance for, which are anatoxin and microcystin, exceed the recreational guidance from Vermont.
And from a recreational standpoint, those visual assessments are more important because even those cells that aren't producing toxins could start doing it. Like I said, we don't know when they produce them. So instead of relying on the presence or absence of toxins, we look to the presence or absence of algae to be our indicator.
And really the message is if it's green and scummy, stay out. Mm-hmm. All right, we're talking about blue-green algae today. We're learning a little bit about why it can be dangerous for pets and humans, but it also does play a role in the aquatic landscape. And it's kind of a unique structure and specimen, as we've been hearing about. So we're going to talk about coming up how we are actually feeding these algae blooms, and we're going to learn a little bit more about its beneficial role in the ecosystem. If you have a question about blue-green algae, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Angela Shambaugh is an aquatic biologist with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and Mike Winslow is a staff scientist with the citizens' advocacy group Lake Champlain Committee. They're helping us get a handle on blue-green algae today. We hear about algae blooms every summer when beaches close to swimmers and pet owners are warned to keep their dogs from drinking toxic water. But how does blue-green algae bloom, and why is it only sometimes dangerous? That's what we're talking about today. We've got another 10 minutes or so on the program. And if you have a question, you can post it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. So before we get more into people who have concerns about blue-green algae, why should we have at least a modicum of respect for this cyanobacteria?
They play a pretty important role in the environment. Some of them have the capacity to do what we call nitrogen fixation, which is actually take nitrogen out of the air in its gaseous form. They use it to grow, but then when they decay, that nitrogen is available for other organisms in the water to use for their own growth. And the same thing can be said with you know, harnessing sunlight. It's just, they also use sunlight to generate the energy that they need to grow, but they're capturing it then in their bodies. And when those bodies are consumed either through bacterial decomposition or directly by somebody else eating them, then that energy from the sun is available for them. They feed the bottom of the food web. We couldn't have the fishing, you know, the great fishing that we have in Lake Champlain and some of our other lakes if we didn't have algae and that kind of thing feeding and moving that energy into an aquatic system.
And as you said earlier, Mike, it is actually food for other animals, exactly. Mollusks and yeah. And phytoplankton and stuff.
The problem comes when we create conditions that cause too much blue-green algae.
All right, well, let's go there. So we are feeding the blue-green algae, right? How are we doing that?
We focus on phosphorus as the nutrient that most limits their growth, and that's been the case since at least the 1970s, that if there's not enough phosphorus, they can't develop. We've gotten to a situation where there's more than enough phosphorus, and particularly in certain parts of the lake, the Missisquoi Bays and St. Albans Bays, and that's why we see the blooms there. And there are some researchers coming out of the Great Lakes and such, they're focusing now on nitrogen as a limiting nutrient. Angela, the assumption has been that because some of these cyanobacteria can take nitrogen out of the air, we didn't have to worry about it. But there is more research coming out lately that suggests there's enough phosphorus now that nitrogen can be a limiter.
Yeah, we've provided enough of one nutrient, but we all need multiple nutrients to grow. The research has always shown that there's a flipping, if you will, between what's most important at any particular time, depending on what's available. And once you have lots of phosphorus, then all of a sudden it's nitrogen that you're paying attention to. So it does play a role.
And the other factor that really helps their growth is warm water. They do better when the water gets warmer, and we've certainly been experiencing hotter summers. Our surface water temperatures in August in Lake Champlain have increased by 5 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit, and that promotes growth as well.
So you are looking at perhaps climate change having an effect on how much algae we have in our lakes.
Exactly, and that's borne out because we are seeing increases in blue-green algae blooms worldwide. It's not a Lake Champlain phenomenon alone.
Correct.
So we had a lot of rain in June, and we've had rain through June and hot weather. We, as we mentioned, have already seen a couple of beaches closed because of blue-green algae in the Burlington area just in the past week. Angela, is this early for blue-green algae?
No, we've had blooms in the past. Right around July 4th is when we start working with the health department to remind people what blue-green algae look like and how to take care. We've certainly had blooms a little bit earlier than we had this year. But for the main lake, this is sort of not unexpected.
Does all that rain in June contribute to more runoff, which then contributes to more blue-green algae?
It's all connected. Everything that's running off the land that carries sediment, phosphorus, is carrying it to a river and directly then to Lake Champlain and any other lake that lies between where that, you know, runoff is coming from before it reaches Lake Champlain. And that is phosphorus that's available for not only for cyanobacteria, but for any other algae that's out there. Right now, Lake Champlain is blooming with diatoms and green algae as well. The samples that I analyze are not solid cyanobacteria. There's a huge population, a very varied population, and they're all responding to phosphorus.
We've got a lot of questions from listeners. Let's go to a few of them. Andy's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Andy. Go ahead.
My question is, some of the cysts that are generated by the bacteria are used in research and are very expensive. Has anybody considered harvesting and extracting these cysts?
system?
What do you mean by systems, Andy?
The systems, the toxins that the cyanobacteria generate.
Ah, okay.
In the cells.
There's definitely research looking into good health effects that may come from some of the cyanobacteria products. There are folks that are looking at the use of them for biofuels and that kind of thing. Interestingly enough, even though we see them as a visible scum, the amount of actual material that's produced in a bloom probably isn't enough to make it economically viable at this point to harvest from Lake Champlain. That may change in the future, but for right now, that's still very new.
Folks that really want to collect blue-green algae for biofuels or any other purpose find that it's easier to grow them themselves than to try to harvest them.
While we're on this topic, let's go to Connie in Greensboro. Hi, Connie. Go ahead.
Hi. This is a good follow-up question. Every now and then at a health food store or someplace, you might see a flyer advertising selling blue-green algae for health purposes. Do you know what that's about? Is that a different type of blue-green algae?
Yeah, Connie, thanks for the call.
In some cases, it is a different kind of blue-green algae. Spirulina is the one probably that's been grown for the longest period of time. Most of those are grown in controlled situations like Mike was talking about. The folks that grow them are very much aware of toxins. But if you choose to purchase something like that, you should always do your research. There are places that do testing to make sure that these compounds don't carry the toxins. And so that's something that you definitely want to do research in before you decide to go the route of the health supplement that includes a cyanobacteria.
Good questions coming in on blue-green algae. If you'd like to add yours to the mix, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post notes or photos on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Ernest in Jericho. Hi, Ernest. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I know that microbiology is always growing, especially in the last year. My question is that I understand that bacteria communicates with one another even inside of like a seed that you might want to plant. So when we have the big rains here and we get phosphorus runoff and also sewage, how bad is that for Lake Champlain when they all just meet in a large body of water if they could communicate with each other?
Ooh, sort of interesting stuff. So maybe Angela or Mike, you could break this apart a little bit because one of the questions is, do bacteria communicate with one another and how? And then, it sounds like Ernest is talking about when we do have these sewage overages and lots of runoff coming in, does that create sort of an even worse environment? So I'm not sure how the communication is connected to that, but maybe you could tease that apart a little bit.
Yeah. So it is possible that they communicate. That may be one function of what we call toxins, is that them communicating with one another and saying, hey, there's enough of us now to stop growing. That's certainly a feasible hypothesis.
But they're not necessarily saying, hey, guys, come on over here. There's a ton of runoff. Come join the party.
No, and what they may be doing, and that chemical signal, it goes by the name quorum sensing, and it's not just cyanobacteria. There are other bacteria that very clearly seem to do this. A lot of times it has to do more with the fact that I'm looking for somebody else like me, someone else from my particular species, because it's time for us to reproduce, and so I'd really like to track you down. Or there's a benefit to be gained by us working together, not necessarily in response to nutrient, but to something else.
Jeff in North Hero emailed in to say, I'd like to know more about the risks associated with long-term chronic exposure for those of us who spend a lot of time on and near the lake. What is the risk from boating and fishing near the algae blooms, from swimming, from living next to the lake, from the wind, and from our drinking water supply?
It's a tough question. The research on that is still very new. There are folks that are investigating what it means to be exposed to aerosols from the surface of the lake. We're also looking at fish consumption as well. What we found is that the testing doesn't always necessarily provide us with a good enough answer to be able to make recommendations about that. So it's in your best interest to limit your exposure if you can. If you're going to be eating fish from the lake, make sure that you've cleaned things really well. Don't consume the guts and things, which is where, if they're eating the algae may accumulate. Make sure that your fillets are really clean and that you're also washing your hands and yourself when you swim. to get anything off the surface that you might have picked up as you're swimming.
We're certainly more aware of the acute effects, the short-term right. impacts of blue-green algae. As Angela noted, the whatever long-term effects might exist aren't really clear. There's not a strong signal there, and I would hate to discourage people from using the lake, either swimming Correct. Or fishing or however they do it, because the benefits of being outdoors far outweigh any of those long-term risks.
Let's go to Thomas in Newport. Hey, Thomas, go right ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, as myself, being a Mother Nature's helper, if you will, what can I do or other concerned citizens do about it? Should we attempt to clean it up or remove it? Should we contact somebody? And the other question is, do we have pictures posted somewhere of what an actual bloom looks like?
Yeah, first of all, we do have pictures posted at our website. If you go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition, but you can also find some in the links that we've provided. There are plenty of pictures up on with the Lake Champlain Committee and elsewhere to find out what it looks like. But Thomas also wants to know, what can he do? Should he try to collect it and report it?
Definitely report it. The Lake Champlain Committee and the Vermont Department of Health both have numbers and ways that you can get out there and report a bloom. And we don't want to hear it, not just from Lake Champlain, but any other public access lake that you happen to be on. It's not easy. You don't really pick it up and clean it. It's just not that kind of thing. It will take care of itself, depending, as we saw here on North Beach, when the wind comes up and the circulation changes, it can disappear very, very rapidly. Usually it's gone within a week, 2 weeks, under situations where it's not, not like a lot of nutrients in the water. So it's not something that you're going to clean up yourself. If you have a small pond, which we've been getting reports this year that people are having algae issues on their small ponds, then we encourage you to contact the Department of Environmental Conservation. We can talk to you a little bit more about what might make sense for your pond.
And we're still obviously looking at runoff problems and how people are contributing to phosphorus loads in the lake. And so that's another prevention, a much larger discussion, but how we can prevent more nutrients going into the lake. Yeah. Mike, are you still looking for volunteers if Thomas wanted to volunteer to become a monitor?
We are still looking for volunteers. The bulk of our training is done. We're about 4 weeks into the program right now, but a lot of my time is reviewing what monitors are doing and along with other projects we have. So it's a little harder to accept them at this time, but we'll take those names and definitely get them on the list for next year when we do the trainings again.
That's Mike Winslow. He's a staff scientist with the Lake Champlain Committee, a citizens advocacy group. We've also been talking with Angela Shambaugh, an aquatic biologist with the Department of Environmental Conservation. Thanks to both of you for helping us understand blue-green algae a little bit better. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
Coming up, why it's important to have accessible outdoor spaces for people who use wheelchairs or other mobility devices to get around. We'll take note of the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This month marks the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA prohibits discrimination against people with physical and cognitive impairments, and it requires employers to make reasonable accommodations to employees who have disabilities. It also set out accessibility requirements for public spaces. Earlier this summer, I met up with a Vermont family that thinks a lot about what accessible space actually means. I wanted to meet them out on a trail so we could talk about the value of getting outside for people who use wheelchairs. But as you'll see, we were stymied in our attempt by one small footbridge that had been flooded out and not yet repaired.
I'm Ash Brittenham, and I'm 17, soon to be 18, and live in Montpelier, Vermont.
And you get around using a wheelchair?
Yep, the snazzy one.
And who are you?
I'm Kim Brittenham. I'm Ash's mom. And an ADA geek. I know way too much about the Americans with Disabilities Act and standards for the built environment and programs and services.
And Kim, are you an ADA geek because you've become an advocate for your son?
Yeah, I've always liked wheeled vehicles. I'm a motorcyclist and come from a family of motorcyclists and worked in that industry. And Ash started using a wheelchair maybe 8 or 9 years ago, and now he uses it all the time. And so for our family, it really impacted where we could go, what businesses we could go to, where we could eat, where we could be outside. So yeah, I started to learn about the ADA and started working with this disability rights organization, the Vermont Center for Independent Living. and I provide their ADA technical assistance and training.
Well, speaking of places that you can go, maybe you guys could describe where we are. Listeners may be able to hear some sounds, people shouting. Sounds like a good time. It's so windy. Yeah, loud hyper children. Ash, where are we?
We are at the Waterbury Reservoir. There's a nature trail here, and we're at the swimming area right now.
We had originally planned to come out here and go walking on a really lovely trail here at the reservoir, and it wasn't available because there's been flooding here and they're working to get it repaired, a little footbridge. And, you know, for somebody who's used to running around on trails and doesn't need a wheelchair, that might not actually be much of an impediment. You could probably just jump over the little wet ditch and head onto the trail. And for your family and for Ash, that's not a possibility.
Just one step for somebody that uses a wheelchair and doesn't get out of a wheelchair is, you know, the whole difference of going inside or getting outside or not.
Bridges here, sometimes there's a gap between that and, like, the gravel. Sometimes you need to, like, bring a piece of plywood with you to drive over, which is a little sketchy.
What do you like about being able to be outside, go on the trails, you know, wheel yourself around as fast as you can?
Yeah, I like to move really fast, and I'm kind of a show-off. In some places, like on the Stowe Bike Path or whatever else, sometimes, like, I go places and ambush the people who I was walking with but got ahead of.
And Kim, you were telling me that Ash really likes to run around with his little brother, and that that's an important part for your family as well of being outside, is all of you being able to go places together.
His little brother has done everything, I think, on this wheelchair. This is a power wheelchair, and it can go 6.5 or 7.5 miles an hour. So on a smooth straightaway, we're not talking a hiking trail, but like a bike path or a smooth surface, they can really go a distance. But he'll ride on the back. He'll stand on the back of the chair. When he was little, we would mount his baby carrier to the back of the chair, and he would sit kind of like a motorcyclist up above Ash's head. And he just loves speed.
Yeah, oh yeah, he used to call all wheeled vehicles vrooms.
In the interest of transparency, when we were talking before the interview, one of the things that you're concerned about is you don't want, you know, reporters or people like me to come up and say, what are all the terrible things that you can't do, or why aren't people making it better for you? And you worry that, you know, you expressed to me that you didn't want an interview to come out that made it sound like a pity party for you.
Yeah.
I completely understand that, first of all, the desire not to be defined by something that's physical.
Even you know, if that it does define me, it does quite a bit, but it's not really the assumption that people should be making, and it's not really that I am somehow some inspiration because of my disability. You know, that's a cliche people use a lot that is not really a good thing to be going on about. But
you were telling me before we started taping about the fact that you graduated from high school a year early, and the fact that you just took a radio course at Goddard, and some of the other things that you're interested in that have nothing to do with how you get around physically in the world.
I know, as Ash's mother, I've known him for 18 years now, that he would go out into the world and make art and be involved in media. But he does have to spend time wondering if he can get into the place, if there's accessible parking there or space for him to move around. But I would say, as being a Vermonter, I've lived here for 25 years, and in Vermont, I think we have an opportunity to create the communities that we want to create. And that when we do that, we need everybody involved in the decision-making process. So I think that we have the chance to have people with disabilities and a variety of perspectives sitting on our design review boards and participating in our municipal government.
When you think about accessible spaces, which you think about a lot, how do you help talk to people about all of the steps that need to be taken to make sure that a space is actually really convenient for all the people who want to use it?
Well, if you're talking about physical space and a physical space working for somebody who uses a mobility device or a walker or is caning or moving slowly, then people want a smooth, stable, slip-resistant surface.
Right.
You know, they want an accessible route. So somebody should look around their facility, whether it's an outdoor facility or a building, and check it for ADA compliance or accessibility. There are ADA checklist tools that people can use to assess their accessible parking, the number of spaces they have, an accessible route to their bathrooms, to their meeting rooms, to the swimming pool, to the tennis court.
Is this a good accessible space here at the Waterbury Reservoir State Park?
It is. When we came over to this bench right here, Ash chose to use the grass, which is not an accessible route. But right behind us, when we leave, he's going to use the accessible route, which is this packed gravel. It's like stay mat. It's at least 36 inches wide. I'm looking at it
that
now.
Looks pretty good. I think recently they added there's this like metal ramp near the water that brings you down to the level of the water, which is pretty easy if you like want it. I don't know, transfer in. It's different the way different people get into the water.
I know in Vermont, in the state parks here, they also have a policy for other power-driven mobility devices, OPDMDs. Those are devices that are powered by something, but that aren't created like to be a piece of medical equipment, but somebody might use to go hunting, perhaps, you know, like an ATV on a state access trail. You know, not everybody's allowed to do that, but if you're a hunter and you need a mobility device, they might allow you to bring that onto state lands. The Segway is also a other power
trip. Those things are weird.
The Segways?
Segways are weird. Have you ever seen one of those? It looks so dorky.
Kim, you and Ash were both describing some of the things here at this park. Is that pretty standard at parks and outdoor spaces where you guys like to go in Vermont?
It's increasing. I have worked with state parks for the past at least 4 or 5 years to increase accessibility at specific state parks. So my colleague Mike Sharon and I have met with them, and there's a website that tourism has done called inclusivevermont.com that has a Google map on it, and it, you can search it for specific accessible elements. I know about them because we've worked on some of them, but there is an accessible boat launch that's going in at Branbury to memorialize Hector Racine, who is an avid hunter and fisher who used a wheelchair and was a strong disability rights activist here in Vermont. We're having an ADA celebration at the Shaftesbury State Park on July 24th, and there's an accessible bus from Bennington that's going out there, and there's an adaptive sports kayaking program that is going to be setting up that day. So I would encourage people to visit the inclusivevermont.com and look at that Google map for specific accessible outdoor rec opportunities.
That was Kim and Ash Brittenham, and we will have links to the resources that Kim mentioned up at vpr.net. One of the things we love about working on Vermont Edition is reading the comments you send us about the show, sometimes long after the broadcast is over. So joining me to share a few of our listener mail pieces is managing producer Patty Daniels. Patty, take it away.
Okay, so Jane, lately there has been a lot of attention and some pop culture fascination around a few celebrities who are transgender. But last week we talked to a few people in Vermont who are also transgender to learn what their experiences are like here. And we got a lot of positive response to that program, but we also got some pushback. Part of the discussion focused on kids who struggle with gender identity, and that prompted one listener, Kevin, to criticize our choice to take up the topic. Here's what Kevin says. Though I don't always agree, I understand certain positions and opinions. I even understand the transgender issues more than one might think. However, to talk about providing hormone therapy to prepubescent children as if it's as normal as discussing the weather, I truly believe at this point your programming staff has gone completely insane.
We also heard from Representative Bill Lippert, who writes, I think it's important for your listeners to know that in Vermont, transgender people have more legal protections than, unfortunately, in most other states. Vermont's also one of only a few states that will issue a new clean birth certificate, changing the gender market as well as any name change, not just crossing out the original information when substituting the new gender marker and name. Vermont also protects transgender citizens in our hate crime statutes.
Okay, moving on to another show from last week. What do we mean when we call a politician a populist? We dug into the history of populist movements and learned how that label is rightly or wrongly applied to modern politicians. And Mark posted this thought. I think in many cases, the term populist is used by major parties and party candidates to categorize their opposition as being non-mainstream. I think it's kind of a scare tactic to evoke images of a mob with torches and pitchforks coming to take your property and your money in order to undercut the populist impact of other candidates.
Yesterday, we talked to and about Bina 48, a robot in Lincoln, Vermont, and the vision of artificial intelligence her creators at the TerraSEM Movement Foundation are exploring. Not everyone is so jazzed about technological immortality. Robinson emailed, I am tired of hearing about the tedious and all too popular impulse to digitize or computerize every aspect of existence today. Life is for living. So many of us have missed the point.
And finally, our program on how to talk to your family about your end-of-life wishes prompted one listener to express his thanks to people who helped his mother die peacefully. Randall writes, my mother moved from Maryland to Vermont last October for the last 6 weeks of her life. The quality of the VNA care and Vermont Respite House care was truly outstanding, so much so that my mother changed her Washington Post obituary for donations to go to the Vermont Respite House. Rest assured that as difficult as end-of-life care is, Vermont is fortunate to be staffed by true, caring, and competent professionals.
Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome, Jane.
Well, we always want to know your impressions and reactions to what you hear on Vermont Edition and your ideas of what you want to hear on the show. You can find us on social media or write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. All right, that's it for today. Tomorrow, Congressman Peter Welch joins us. We'll talk about the Iran deal, the transportation bill, and more. And you can send all of your questions for Congressman Welch to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Then be sure to listen tomorrow at noon or 7. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.